I'm just eliminating all those pictures of people and myself. It's rather annoying. Thank you. I would have really loved to be there, but it's challenging for me to get into town, and with the ferries as insane as they are, it's a little bit difficult. It's great that I'll just let Flo sort of lead the charge from the Sunshine Coast over there. Before I begin, I really want to dedicate this talk to the memory of my father. It's Father's Day, and you know, like many people, I had a complicated a complicated relationship with my dad, and you know, I realized that he loved me the best he could, and you know, I always really wasn't able to see that. So thank you, Dad. Anyway, I'm really honored to have the opportunity to speak to you this morning. You know, I'm really, really grateful to be part of this Sangha. And I'm so happy that we're able to, you know, be around visually. There's many in the province who benefit from this. And, you know, I'm really inspired each time I step into the virtual or the actual Zendo and find, you know, you're all here, you know, click and then everybody's there. It's really amazing. And I really want to thank, you know, Miocean, Kate McCandless and Shinmon, Michael Newton, who have really dedicated their lives to the Dharma and are a great source of support and inspiration to me. And I also want to thank Dai Flo Ruble for being my Dharma friend, and as well as Karen Laurie. You know, Sangha is truly all of the holy life, as the Buddha said. Zed Talks offer an opportunity to hear how the Dharma expresses itself through our practice. Hearing others affirms my commitment and inspires me to my own practice. So I want to thank all the people who've stepped up before me. I'm not sure how inspiring my talk will be, but I'm pretty sure that you'll come away with a new appreciation of sawdust. And that's why I called my talk Chop Wood, Carry Water, Attend Meetings, Make Sawdust. You're likely familiar with the Zen saying, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. You know, I've always loved that image. I imagine, you know, the weight of a wooden pail filled with the brim with cool, clean, well water, you know, the sharp clack of a crack of a maul that, you know, is a cleaving an aromatic for a block. You know, it really captures the purity and precision of Zen. But somehow my own practice lacks this kind of romance. There's not a lot of that kind of purity and precision as I prepare for an upcoming meeting, review an agenda, read reports, examine spreadsheets, or in the moment I recognize a portion of a sculpture I've just spent hours working on simply doesn't work and has to be removed with a quick stroke of the chainsaw. Or during the day when I struggle with constant fatigue or must stop what I'm doing because of shortness of breath. You know, surely I must be doing something wrong. But in luck, you know, if I'm really lucky in that moment, you know, Michael's voice is there and reminds me to be with this life, this moment, fully, completely, just as it is. So I start again. And, you know, really remembering and starting again is the heart of the of our practice. And I remind myself that for our ancestors, chopping wood and carrying water probably didn't have the romance I imagine. These tasks had to be done day in, day out. It was dark, it was rainy, and people were cold and tired. And I could just imagine somebody, you know, grumpy and irritated at having to go out again and get more water to do more dishes. And, you know, maybe one of those ancestors thought too, hey, you know, thought of the words of their teacher, and they started again too. This morning, I want to examine what the practice of starting again or of cultivating beginner's mind looks like in three areas of my life: my work with hospice as a volunteer and board member, my exploration of wood sculpture, and living with a life-limiting illness. So what's starting again or beginner's mind? When we remember to come back into our body and start again, whether it's on the cushion, in a meeting, while making our bed, or when we're irritated by our partner, we can open to beginner's mind. And, you know, I was sitting, getting ready, I just, you know, all the times that, you know, my mind wandered or whatever, I was distracted. And, you know, it's always again and again, just coming back. And so really for me, it's irritating sometimes, but sometimes I think, oh, just another opportunity to wake up. I first encountered the notion of beginner's mind in February of 1974, when I was a student at the University of Alberta. It's really cold that day. And I went to a bookstore and I bought this great book. I found it. And I still have it. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shinryu Suzuki. You know, it had been only out for 4 years. And, you know, like I kept this book, and like I even have the bookmark, which is like kind of amazing to me. As many of you know, Suzuki Roshi is the Zen ancestor who brought Zen from Japan to North America. And his student, Norman Fisher, is our founding teacher. Now, at this point in the talk, I'd like to say I read the book and it transformed my life. But to be honest, I was mostly confused by the language and the ideas. And yet at some level, I connected with, I think, what were glimmers of the Dharma. Now, surprisingly, almost 50 years later, after a meandering path of practice, I'm somewhat less confused and still learning daily what it means to practice with beginner's mind. For me, beginner's mind is best illustrated in this koan from the Book of Serenity. Daizang said to Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, "I'm on a pilgrimage." "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" "I don't know." "Not knowing is the most intimate." Fayan suddenly had a great awakening. For me, intimacy describes the openness, warmth, and affection that permeates awareness. It is an encounter with life grounded in the body, alive to the world. Intimacy is only possible when we accept we don't know and step into beginner's mind. When we let go of our notions of control, our expectations and sense of entitlement. When we admit we have no clue. Beginner's mind requires us to set down our baggage. You know, I have an image of my own pilgrimage, weighed down by a bulging backpack, heavy shoulder bag pulling down on one shoulder, a duffel bag barely held up in one hand, a rolling suitcase with a broken wheel trailing in the other. An array of plastic bags and random objects tied onto and hanging to the whole mess. You know, it's such a relief to put that baggage down, the baggage of judgment and expectation. Suzuki Roshi observed, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind, there are few. Dropping our baggage and meeting the world with our whole self allows us to respond creatively to the world. Creativity is life expressing itself. Life continually invents and reinvents, responds to ever-changing conditions, and work with what is. It's all improvisation. So my practice in the last few years has focused on increasing my capacity for intimacy and creativity. And I'll talk about those three areas now. First area is practice and my engagement with hospice. Since retiring 12 years ago, I've been involved in the hospice society here on the Sunshine Coast. I was initially drawn to this work as a volunteer, providing direct service to clients and their loved ones. As a volunteer, I offered compassionate presence to people living with life-limiting illness, individuals who are actively dying, and grieving family. The essence of hospice work is compassionate presence. In my work with hospice, I've had the opportunity to better understand what compassionate presence is, how it might be expressed, and whether or not individuals we can develop compassionate presence. I'm really interested in that question. The development of compassionate presence. Zen practice is the foundation of my work with hospice. And, you know, some of the best people in the field are Zen practitioners. Roshi Zone Halifax in Paya, New Mexico, and Francos Deseski in San Francisco. And I took the opportunity to go and study with them, and they were really transformative experiences. But also Norman Fisher, our founding teacher, has written extensively on working with the dying. And his work has been very helpful, as well as the work of Susan Moon and Darlene Cohn, who are students of Suzuki Roshi. So I'll talk about direct service and then non-direct service in hospice. Beginner's mind expresses itself in hospice as a compassionate presence, and through practice, we can develop this capacity. Practices allows us to become aware of the intention we bring to the work. And I really, intention is so important. Rachel Remen provides a really great way of thinking about intention when we want to, work with people or do good works or whatever you have. She asks us to consider whether our intention is to help, fix, or serve. When we help, we come from a place that ignores the agency of the other, and we seek to create dependency. And when we seek to fix, we know what is best and we want to impose. But to serve, that's to show up, to be with what is and to do what is required. And that is when we're our most resourceful, and that's where solutions present themselves. And it is really the most intimate, and it really allows us to respond creatively. Intention alone is not enough. Our bodhisattva vows inspire us to live our intention. This is really a challenge for those working in hospice work or anyone who wants to offer support. Roshi Joan Halifax developed a beautiful practical model that describes what we need to do to make that transformation, to make that transition. She developed the grace model. And in summary, it basically involves first being fully present in our body, deeply connected to our intention, fully aware of what is happening, responding appropriately and creatively, and letting go of any judgments. It's a really powerful tool, and she has done just a phenomenal job, and you can find out more about her work if you go to Upaya Zen Center. So as part of my practice, I took on the training of volunteer orientation, and I was a teacher too. So I revamped the curriculum, and I made the grace model the foundation of the 30 hours of training for our hospice volunteers. Now, obviously they're not Zen practitioners, but one of the great things that Kate does is she reminds us that, I don't think Zen has the monopoly on wisdom, and so we're able, there's so many opportunities for us to transform and communicate Zen ideas in ways that are, certainly not, you don't need to be a practitioner. So going back to developing compassionate presence, when I started as a volunteer, I thought compassion was something that you did, with another person, like holding their hand or offering up a tea or listening, holding space. And it is, it really is. And we recognize it, but compassion isn't ours to give, and it's not for our clients to receive. And, like any gift, it's empty, and there's no giver, no receiver, and no gift. It's a really profound shift in terms of the way we think about compassion. And it's also a profound shift in thinking about how compassion arises, can then arise, because compassion can only realize in the context of an organization, which, the hospice society is an expression of compassion. And so if I want to live my vows, I was really called to offer direct service by joining the board and, serving as president. And, at the time, because we're working board, was president/executive director. And, you know, I took a number of public education and fundraising activities and provided training for volunteers and all of that. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's all compassion expressing itself. So when you're not on the cushion, when you're not on one-on-one, like, what is it to bring compassion to those tasks? Well, you know, the first thing is working with intrusion. I called it an intrusion just for the sake of this talk, but, you know, there's inevitably, there are times when you know, I've resented the demands that all of these demands placed on me, you know, but my practice allowed me to acknowledge these feelings, recall my intention, and, you know, go back to what will serve and what will allow me to contribute to the benefit of others. You know, if I develop policy or we make decisions during meetings or we raise money, this all helps us raise money and be able to offer services to our clients. The other thing that is helpful with practice is that when you work in those kinds of roles, offering, you know, you're there, you're in a situation where you have to manage people. You have to work with directors who, you know, there's like 13 people on our boards. So you have to work with those directors. We have staff. And, you know, it's always not straightforward with people. So, you know, in those relationships, there's lots of opportunities for beginner's mind and lots of opportunities to fail. But, you know, each of those opportunities is a chance to begin. And, you know, the work also calls on us to practice the paramitas of patience and perseverance. Patience with others and with ourselves, and perseverance at starting over again and seeing our reactivity and judgment for what they are, then coming fresh to the problem or situation. So, hospice work. Another thing that I do and I've had the opportunity to explore is wood sculpting. So two and a half years ago, I started to do wood sculpture. I have a dear friend and mentor, Dave, and we work together and we reclaim old growth cedar from the log sort just outside of Langdale. The log sort off the Sunshine Coast is the largest log sort in North America. And all the logs that from the West Coast, you know, up all the sounds of the West Coast and even some from Vancouver Island, come here and they're sorted there in these like huge football field size spaces with these gigantic machines. And then they're boomed up and they're brought to the Fraser River and milled there. Unfortunately, amongst those booms, our old growth cedar. There's actually quite a bit of it, a surprising amount of it. And when it's being sorted, anything that is not merchantable timber is lopped off or put aside, and they burn it to fuel the pulp mill there. Or what they do is they pulp it, and it's actually really a problem. And so what we do is we get it from them, we haul it home, and you know, we carve it. And what we want to do is we create these abstract sculptures. And what we want to really do is we want to really, you know, reveal some of the grace of energy that those trees still have. We're drawn and influenced by the organic lines and curves and shapes found in nature, and particularly in form line. Beginner's mind is really the foundation of my work as an artist. You know, moving with tools, feeling the flow of the line in your body, using your fingers to feel the bend of a curve, and even the smell of, you know, red and yellow cedar, or just being alive to the whirling wood grain. All of that's important. But always returning to, you know, beginner's mind, always coming back to that place and starting with what is. And, you know, the pieces we get are not these pristine pieces, like they're shattered by machines, or you know, they've got rot in them, they have craggy knots, but you know, that's what you start with. And as in Zazen, to sculpt is to be like, it's embodied. To be doing wood sculpture is an invitation to really use beginner's mind. The critical mind that drives the bus most of the time has to take a back seat to let creativity work. My friend Dave describes it as like being on the piece. When I'm the piece, my senses are my guide. I'm looking for a line, running my fingers over it, working with tentative strokes and just, toggling back and forth, making sure that the results are, harmonious, and asking myself, is this expressing beauty? But beginner's mind also means that I have to let go of how I want the piece to be and tune in with it. When I don't recognize that I'm attached to a particular outcome, that sense of intimacy is lost. And like I keep pushing forward and repeating the same, trying to do the same thing. And then I just lose it. And then at that point, when I sort of stop and let go, I go, oh my God, it's ruined. That moment of mistake is like, oh my God, a catastrophe. And, there's all that rush for judgment. And then I go, oh, no, a mistake. No. Beginner's mind reminds me that, oh, this is just how it is right now. A new opportunity. It doesn't always feel like a new opportunity, but it does. And when it does, I just remove the piece. Often I just leave it aside and then I come back again. A moment of letting go, a moment of beginner's mind. So, on to learning to live with a life-limiting illness. Right now, I'm learning to live with advanced kidney disease, along with a pretty restricted cardiovascular function. I experience frequent fatigue and shortness of breath, and many of the daily activities I do are difficult, and I've had to really, cut back in a lot of areas. It's been hard having to get help to maintain our beautiful garden, and like hiking, backpacking, and cycling, which I love, are just like, they're really not in the cards. And, what's even more difficult is that, the limited energy means I've had to reduce my involvement with hospice and even wood carving. Running a chainsaw and working with an angle grinder are pretty fatiguing. So learning. There's acceptance, and learning to adjust this change in health over the last 2 years has not been easy. And my years of practice have really, really proved to be helpful. Ever since I first came across it, I've come back and again and again to Rumi's poem, The Guest House. You probably know it. Rumi says, our being human is a guest house, and we are welcome. We are to welcome and entertain all visitors and be grateful because each is sent from a guide from beyond. He says it more eloquently and poetically than me. But, that's not my guest house. No. Decreased capacity, increasing symptoms. We're not welcome. My door, firmly shut and locked. And, I don't care how much knocking you have or what the doorbell says, I'm not opening. And that, and I realize that that's really where the rub lies. All guests are unwelcome. My focus was entirely on keeping out those I didn't want. And of course it meant not letting in those who I wanted to have in. So what I really wanted was, I wanted, as a good Buddhist, I wanted like acceptance. I wanted equanimity. And I really, last January and February, I was really working with equanimity. Oh, I'm equanimity. And I realized so many things about equanimity. I saw equanimity or acceptance as a noun, but they're not nouns, like they're verbs. Like it's something that you just work to and keep coming back to over and over again. And importantly, beginner's mind invites us to welcome the resistance and denial. And denial really has a bad rap. It's had a hard go of it. And I think it's because, while society, we generally pay scant attention to death and grief, It seems we've integrated Kubler-Ross's description of the stages of grief, which have to be, we think we have to be worked through and to achieve some kind of acceptance. And, denial is seen as, really misguided. Oh, that, that person's in denial. It's like a trap we fall into and, on the way to acceptance. But, with beginner's mind, we can recognize the denial. We can recognize denial and welcome it and respect it for what it is. And it allows us time, the time we need to deeply process and adjust to any seismic shift in our lives. Acknowledging denial, seeing what it is over and over again, becoming intimate with it, that's beginner's mind. But, it's not always easy to have beginner's mind. I have to remember over and over again. And there's a number of things that I, have to deal with, like when I'm, when I can't do tasks, like, I'm having a hard time doing daily tasks or frustrated. So when it comes to frustration and sadness, they're around. And I resent the fact that this should be so hard, or I can't be the way it was, or how this situation will only get worse in the future. Those are the second arrows. The first arrow, obviously, is the experience. I have to see these thoughts and feelings for what they are, thoughts, feelings, and begin again and be with the foggy mind of the moment or the lungs seeking to replenish the body. I have to start again. And this is where our bodhisattva vows really help. Recalling our vows reminds us of where we want to be and our commitment to always start again. Delusions are inexhaustible. Dharma gates are boundless. Working with fatigue is probably the greatest challenge. I'm deeply identified being with the person who gets things done. I'm the kind of person for whom, as Ross Gay observed, there's a barbed wire tether between time and virtue. Beginner's mind asks me to show up for the fogginess and feelings of lethargy, to experience them fully. And when I remember to do this, I use this simple phrase recommended by Michael Connolly. Yes, and yes, fogginess. Yes, I have to sit down now. And when I do, there's a moment to respond creatively and to improvise. When I feel tired, my first reaction is often annoyance. I don't like this. Comparing minds tells me I miss my mental clarity, how the fatigue is more frequent or more intense, how there must be something I can do. In that moment, when I say yes, I can open to everything else arising in that very same moment. And I'm just going to relate to you an episode where my property's on a pretty steep property and hill, and I have to walk up, and I can't walk up the hill anymore. And so I have benches that I sit down on. And so, my legs ache, I sit down, and then I'm feeling breathless. And so instead of going and, going off on whatever about the fatigue, this is the experience I had sitting under this beautiful Styrax japonica that's blooming with these beautiful star-shaped flowers that I sat under. Okay, so, there's the fatigue, and then I open, and then I hear the spiraling trill of the varied thrush. I feel my buttocks and back hard in the seat, the distant drone of a plane, the rise of my chest in the in-breath, the caress of a breeze on my face as it ripples through the ferns, the dryness of lips in the mouth, the slight thump of a spent flower dropping into a broad green leaf of hosta. All of this I could have missed, and I was missing when I was preoccupied with my reactivity to my breathlessness. And the breathlessness is really, having breathlessness is really ironic. For years, I knew I needed to slow down and stop periodically. to let go of onto the next mind, the mind that propels us forward. And, you know, Michael has done such a great job of talking about that mind. And, I actually, getting ready for this talk, I went back and listened to one of his Labor Day talks, and they're just brilliant because it describes me so much to a T. And all of us really, you know, we're always on to the next thing. But having to sit down now, not because I choose to catch my breath, provides me with that very opportunity to stop and come in my body. And my practice allows me to summon up beginner's mind and see that this moment is an opportunity to wake up and to say yes. And you know, I think of, and I, this makes me think of our incense chant that reminds me, may we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. So, people say that illness is a gift. Well, it's a hard-fought gift and it's a hard price to pay, but it's true. And practice is a gift too, and I'm so glad that I have it. So I want to end today, and I want to end, I want to share with you the words of two Cohens, Darlene and Leonard. First, Darlene Cohen, and I really want to thank Michael for mentioning her in his talk on illness. Darlene Cohen was a longtime student of Suzuki Roshi. She lived with debilitating rheumatoid arthritis for pretty well all of her adult life and sadly died in 2011. Her book, Turning Suffering Inside Out, A Zen Approach to Living with Physical and Emotional Pain, was for me essential reading. And, you know, it's really one of the best Dharma books I've ever read, independent of the fact that I was sick. She's really, really focused on practice and the experience of translating Dharma into life. I really recommend it. In her book, she says this: we need to treat our pain gently, respectfully, not resisting, but living with it. When we do resist it, we need to treat that with respect too. My Zen meditation training turned out to be a great help to me. I simply focused my attention on my immediate experience, my body sensations, my sense impressions, the stream of my consciousness. As in Zen practice, there is no goal involved. There is only the relentless, implacable present. And it is only in the present that we can cultivate the mental stability that is required to practice non-preference for the conditions of our lives. The other Cohen is Leonard. Leonard Cohen. As you probably know, Cohen was a longtime Zen practitioner. His album, 10 New Songs, is a distillation of his Zen experience. I particularly love the song Boogie Street. And if you can listen, if you can find this somewhere on your streaming service, it's really well worth listening to. And the lyric from this, Cohen sings, and I don't have to really compete much because Cohen's voice is, not exactly mellifluous. But I'll leave you with these last words of Cohen. A sip of wine, a cigarette, and then it's time to go. I tidied up the kitchenette. I tuned the old banjo. I'm wanted at the traffic jam. They're saving me a seat. I am what I am. And what I am is back on Boogie Street. So come, my friends, be not afraid. We are so lightly here. It is in love that we are made. In love, we disappear. Thank you.